Tonight I want to share with you a scripture that you may have heard before from me, but it's one of these that you keep coming back to many times, I do, through my whole lifetime. And this has been coming to me anew and afresh, and so I would like to share some thoughts with you tonight on that passage that has meant so much to many of us in Isaiah chapter 58. And if you have your whole Bible with you, would you turn, please, to Isaiah chapter 58. I have an improvement or two, I think, on any previous presentation of this passage. For instance, I now have a title for it. And not that that's much of an improvement. Not too much on titles. I know Doss Trotman, whenever he'd be asked to speak, they'd always ask, well, what's your title? What's your title? So he thought up one title that covered any message, regardless of what it was. And he just, and that title was, The Need of the Hour. You know, the need of the hour might be a drink, it might be confess sin, it may be an exercise, it may be go to the mission field, whatever it was. If they asked for a title, a sermon topic to put it in the bulletin, he just said, oh, The Need of the Hour. Well, this isn't that one. My title for this is If, Then. If, Then. If you'll do this and this, then God will do this and this and this and this and this and this and this. If you will do this and this, then God will do this and 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 this. If, then. Reading in Isaiah chapter 58, the last half of verse 9. If you take away from the midst of you the yoke, the pointing of the finger, and speaking wickedness, if you pour out yourself for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in darkness, and your gloom be as the noonday, and the Lord will guide you continually, and satisfy your desire with good things, and make your bones strong, and you shall be like a garden, like a spring of water, whose waters fail not. And your ancient ruins will be rebuilt. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in. If, then. If you do so and so, God will do such and such. Whenever I have an opportunity, I like to point out that this particular portion, particularly verse 12, was the verse that I thought I got a promise from God on a long time ago that I have never seen fulfilled. There is in one of my other Bibles a note in the margin by Isaiah 58:12, December 1, 1949. Ask God especially for a ministry in South America. And this was during a half day alone with the Lord. Then in April 6, 1954, a little over 5 years later, London re-impressed to claim this promise for further ministry in Latin America. I had gone down and spoken in Costa Rica for a week, but that had been the extent of it. Well, the years went by, and I never got down, in fact, to South America itself until about 3-4 years ago. And I was kind of eager to see when I got down into Brazil if there was any special sign from the Lord that he was going to do something, anything special through me in South America. And I didn't get anything. I had a great time, but there was nothing special. So all I can say is that maybe I didn't get the promise from the Lord. Maybe I just thought so. In which case, I ought to just leave it. If, on the other hand, I did get it from the Lord, well, then he'll work it out. So I'll just leave it with him. A promise isn't something you obey, it's something you believe. And so if I was wrong, okay, I was wrong. If I was right, God will work it out, so I don't sweat that. I don't try to work it out for God. If he wants to do it, if I got it from him, then he'll do it, right? So take a deep breath and relax. Now the setting here in this chapter is that people may have a daily quiet time and even periodic times of fasting, but living in pure hypocrisy if there isn't repentance from sins and a reform of their lives. In verse 2 it says, "Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways." They have a daily quiet time. They delight to know my ways, they say. They even have periods of fasting. But they don't turn away from sin. They're wicked people. And that's pure hypocrisy. Now in verse 6 he says, "Is not this the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh. Then shall your light break forth like the dawn and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard." See, here's a kind of like the idea that we're coming up with in verses 9 through 12. You do thus and so, God will do thus and so. "Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer." Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. Now, I'm sure that all of us here pray. But do we get answers? Are you getting any answers? One of my personal objectives for this year is Philippians 4, 6, and 7. "By everything in prayer and supplication to make my requests known to God." And learn to do that better. I want to learn that. Not just scheme and plan and think and work and struggle, but pray everything. But I want more than that. I also added to my objective and to secure answers. I want to see God answer. Don't you? Well, he says, "Then you shall call and the Lord will answer. You shall cry and he will say, here I am." Not only will you experience answers to prayer, you will experience the presence of the Lord. And how about that? Are you experiencing the personal presence of God in your life these days? Is he a living reality to you? Or does somehow or other kind of seem far off? But we can and should be experiencing continuously the presence of the Lord. I don't mean that you think about him every moment of the day. But the general tenor of our lives is that we experience his presence. And of course, John 14, 21 gives us a secret to it, which is to have his commandments and keep them. Well, that's a little introduction. Now we come to the passage I read. The if part. The if part here has two things. If then. If there's a negative, the cleaning away of the weeds, and then the next if is a positive, something you plant. Something you get rid of, and something you add. He says, "If you take away from the midst of you the yoke, the putting forth of the finger, and speaking witness," or rather wickedness, or vanity, in the King James says. Now, when I think here of the yoke, if you take away from the midst of you the yoke, I think of the yoke of sin. "His own iniquity shall take the wicked himself, and he shall be holden with the cords of his sins." Proverbs 5:22. And you know how a sin once committed is like wrapping a string around your arms. You maybe could break it. You could stop it. But again and again and again, repeated and repeated and repeated, and soon you're holding with the cords of your sins. You're in the grip. And this is why, particularly as we're younger, sin is not dealt with ruthlessly. That begins to get a hold of us, and it wraps around until finally we come at some place we're held in its grip. You remember that Samson was captured by the Philistines. He was bound with his hands behind him. His eyes were put out, and he was put grinding corn like an ox. I heard somebody say once that that's an illustration of sin. The binding, blinding, and grinding power of sin. And I think of Christian workers, people in Christian work. There are two kinds of sin, and Bill Gothard brings these out in his seminar. One has to do with a bad conscience. In other words, we have offended someone else and we've never tried to make it right. And I wonder tonight if you know of anyone that you have wronged and you have never tried to make it right. Well, a bad conscience will paralyze you, won't it? It'll weight you down. It will plague you. Until sometime, somewhere, you've got to go and make it right. You may wait 1 year. You may wait 5. You may wait 15. But sometime, someplace, somewhere, when the Spirit of God finally gets hold of you and you want to get back on the track, you know where you get back on the track? Where you got off. Because we walk down the Christian life this way and we get off here and then we let a long time go and we'd like to get back on the track where we would have been had we not gotten off. But it doesn't work that way, does it? You have to get back on the track where you get off. So if you come in your quiet time and you remember that somebody has something against you, go and make them right and then come back. And of course, the other thing is a bitter spirit, or just the opposite has happened. Someone has wronged you and you resented it and you've allowed it to eat on you. Until this resentment has grown into a bitter spirit that has eaten you up. Sort of a self-cannibalism. And the result is it has put you on the shelf. Not long ago, I forget where I was, somebody, I think it was some navigator, made a talk about the things that put people who've been used of God on the shelf. Money, sex, and the tongue. But in my experience, I think I have seen more people who are useful, no longer useful, because of bitterness than any other one thing. More than money or sex or tongue or whatever, but a bitter spirit. Because it puts you on the shelf. And Hebrews 12:15 is the key verse on that, isn't it? Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God. Lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many others be defiled. Well, again, I thank God for 1 John 1:9, don't you? That if we confess our sins, He's faithful and just to cleanse us, to forgive us, and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. If you put away the yoke of sin. And then he says, the pointing of the finger. Now I take that to mean the contemptuous, that finger, that bony finger of contemptuous criticism. That bony finger that has a long, jagged fingernail. And I think a perfect illustration of what this is talking about is over in Romans 14, the first couple of verses, where Paul says, as for the man who is weak in faith, welcome him without attempting to settle doubtful points, that is, without disputes over opinions. One believes he may eat anything, while the weak man eats only vegetables. And here's the part. Let not him who eats despise him who abstains. And let not him who abstains pass judgment on him who eats. For God has welcomed him. And who are you not to welcome someone that God has welcomed? But the idea here is that the root of this thing is pride, because to pass judgment is to make a formal utterance of an authoritative opinion that points the finger, sort of despising, contemptuous way, at somebody else by way of criticism. And the root of it is that great sin of pride. I am superior in knowledge. But God hates that kind of a thing. It'll put you on the shelf because it sows discord among brethren. And God hates it. And if its root is pride, it says that God resists the proud. Do you want God Almighty, who made heaven and earth, resisting you? I mean, how are you going to get anywhere when God is resisting you? How will any of us get anywhere? There's one thing we better not have at all, in any way, is God resisting us. I mean, who are we when God is resisting us? But God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. And therein also that bony finger of criticism, contemptuous criticism, makes us a tool of the devil, because the devil is the accuser of the brethren. Of course, another reason can be guilt. A lot of times we project our own guilt. See, we feel guilty about what we haven't done or what we have done. And that often expresses itself in aggressive tendencies, either in self-justification or in a critical attack on others. Well, the remedy is what? James says, to humble yourself before the Lord. Be wretched and mourn and weep. Humble yourselves before the Lord and he will exalt you. And again, Paul says in Philippians 2:3, in humility, count others better than yourselves. The two great remedies for this critical attitude that despises and is sort of contemptuous and puts us over and above somebody else. If you take away from the midst of you the yoke of sin, that bony finger of criticism, and speaking wickedness. I like what it says in the King James, the word vanity. And I read somewhere that this word vanity means soap bubbles. Soap bubbles. It looks good, it comes out there, glistens for a moment in the light, but you reach out and get a hold of it, and all you have left is a little damp spot on your fingers. There's nothing there. It's just air, it's just wind. Speaking soap bubbles. A windbag. I remember when I was just a little kid, how it struck me so that my dad came home and he talked about some guy that lived out in a mile or two from us there in the country. They call him Windy. And I said to my mother, well, Windy was overworking on the fence today and I was talking with Windy. I remember saying, well, Daddy, why do you call him Windy? Oh, because he's always bragging and talking a lot, never quits talking. We just all call him Windy. You mean right to his face? Yeah, right to his face. And I remember what an impression it made on me. I hope that no one would ever have occasion to call me Windy. But that's what he's talking about here. A windbag. So soap bubbles, vanity. You know, I wonder how many of our testimonies get exaggerated. How many of our experiences get embellished? Because through the years, we found that we said a little something funny and people laugh, so we add that to the testimony or the message next time. And next time we try a little something new, and then that gets added. And through the years, the original is pretty hard to get back to. But you know something? The truth is never dull. Because life is not dull. There's something that vibrates about life, and we don't have to speak vanity. We don't have to be windbags. We don't have to embellish it for it to strike home to the heart. Then, of course, another windbag is the theorist, the instant expert on everything. You usually find out that the person with all the answers on how to do personal evangelism is not doing personal evangelism. The guy that's trying to do it, or the person that's trying to do it, is looking for answers. The one who isn't doing it, has simply read the books, has the answers. I remember one time sitting at a dinner with maybe 20 people, at which Billy Graham was a guest. And it was strange to me how the conversation turned to various people telling Billy Graham how he ought to give his invitations. And the immense graciousness was with which that man listened and tried to understand and to appreciate the various suggestions, when I know that he was probably 100 times more active and effective than anybody else around that table, maybe all of them put together. He was listening and they were doing the talking. I thought that was quite interesting. Speaking vanity. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus put it like this: let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. All right, that's the first if. That's the negative if. If you take away the yoke of sin, the putting forth of the finger of criticism, and speaking vanity, empty talk. Now the positive if. If you pour out yourself for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted. If you pour out yourself for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted. Now, as I would take it here, the hungry, well, he has a problem within. He needs food. The afflicted, his problem is coming from without, and perhaps he needs protection. Over here in verse 7, it talks about it. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house when you see the naked to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Now, in either case, whether his need is from within or he's getting pressure from without, he says we're to help him. We're to help him. A couple years ago, we asked Leroy Imes to come up with a paper on how to train men. And I remember he called me one day and he said, you know, I want to tell you what I've come up with. I've come up with the thought that there's just one basic principle to helping or to training men. I said, what's that? He said, to meet his need. Whatever his need is, to meet his need. And you know, I think that's pretty good. Yeah, I think that's good. Now, that's what love does. Love is an unselfish concern that freely accepts another and seeks his good or meets his needs. I know as Lucy and I were praying about this year and what our ministry might be, and should it be with couples, and what about the neighbors, and there's maybe four or five possibilities that are before us, and there's some things that we do want to do. But the thing we came up with, that our prime ministry is just to help people. We just want to be alert to help people. And the next person, whether they're 7 or 17 or 70. And I think that's true. We are to help people. We are to pour out our soul to the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, starting in your own household. Because it's so easy for us to push our way out past our wife, over the kids or around them, out somewhere to get out there somewhere to help some people. And maybe some of the loneliest or some of the deepest needs are right there. I think we need to get out there, but we need to have our order of priority. And so one ought to start with his spouse or his roommate or his children. And then one's co-laborers, and then one's neighbors. And you remember when the lawyer that asked Jesus, "Who is my neighbor?" And in answer to that question, "Who is my neighbor?" Jesus told the parable of the Good Samaritan, of the man that fell among thieves, and you remember a priest came along and saw him there. And this man had been beaten and left bruised and half dead, and he passed by on the other side. And then a Levite came by, and he came and looked at where he was, but he also went by. And then this Samaritan came along, and he saw him, and he took him, and he dressed his wounds, pouring him all the wine, put him on his donkey, took him to an inn, and saw to it he got taken care of, and said, "I'll come back later and see how he's doing." And Jesus said, "Now, which was the neighbor?" And I've always thought, well, now how does that answer the original question? And then it came through to me that Jesus is saying that the real question is not, "Who is my neighbor?" The real question is, "Am I neighborly?" And if I am neighborly, if I am seeking to help people, if I am looking for opportunities to pour out myself for the hungry and looking for opportunities to satisfy the desire of the wicked, I will see them. They're there on every hand. But I think one of the great troubles I have on this, I'm too busy. I have myself scheduled. I haven't got time for that. I don't know. I have a hunch that as I read the story of the Good Samaritan, I'm just reading this in, but it says that the priest came where he was. The Levites saw him. I don't think that they were headed anywhere particularly, but it says the Samaritan, as he journeyed, I think he had a schedule to keep. I think he was a businessman. I think he was the one that operated on a self-control program. And yet he was the one that took time out of his schedule. You remember when the disciples had gone on their preaching tour and they came back and gathered themselves together unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And Jesus said, "Come yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while, for there are many coming and going and they had no leisure so much as to eat." Well, that was a great idea. You're going to have a weekend retreat. Maybe a little extra time out of Palm Springs or somewhere. And so they get out there and they're going to have this retreat and they're pooed. I mean, they've not only been out preaching, they haven't had time to eat. And that isn't really the problem that most of us have. We seem to manage that some way. But they get out there and what did they find? 5,000 people waiting for them. So it got late in the day and the disciples came up to Jesus and they said, "Lord, this is a desert place." Now, that's an inane statement. Well, I mean, he was right there. I mean, of course he knew it was a desert place. But see, I think they were trying to get the mental connection in his mind that he had said, "Let's go apart into a desert place and rest a while." Get it, Lord? This is a desert, the rest. You know? This is a desert place. Besides, it's the wrong place to be handling all these people. And they said, "The hour is now past." I mean, it's late in the day. Our business hours are over. It's the wrong place and it's the wrong time to be knocking ourselves out to feed all these people. Jesus said, they don't need to go away. You feed them. Now there's where it is. It's not when I meet my schedule. Oh, yeah, I can schedule people from 3 to 5. But when in the evening at home when they call me. Or I'm out on a trip and I like a little nap after lunch. When it's the wrong place and the wrong time, then to pour out our soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul. If you ever wanted to hear Dawson Trotman yell so you could hear him from the top floor of the office to the bottom, just have somebody come along and say that they didn't do a certain thing or tend to a certain person because that was not in their department. He would literally chew nails. That he'd say, when the day comes that we're so departmentalized that when this person comes along, I can't take myself out to see that it gets to that apartment, that department. Say, well, that's not on my watch. That's not on my department. That was like sticking him with a hat pin. If you pour out yourself for the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul. You know, I was thinking here a couple months ago, I spend a lot of time thinking about what I'm going to say to people. So I made a little note to myself to spend some time thinking about what I'm going to do for people. And if I find if I spend one-tenth the time thinking about what I can do for people that I do and what I'm going to say to people, it's amazing the ideas that come to me of what I can do for this person and that one and the other one. I hear that verse in Hebrews quoted so often about not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together, but I rarely ever hear the main point of the verse, which is, let us consider how, we usually read, let us consider how to get people to assemble together. That isn't what it says. It says, let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works. Let's figure out ways to stimulate people to love other folks and do good things for them. So we should sit around talking about how we can do that. Stimulate one another. Well, that's what he's talking about here. That's the second if. If you pour out yourself for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted. Okay. If you put away these things, if you pour out yourself, then this will happen, and that will happen, and that will happen, and that will happen, and that will happen, and yet something else will happen. Look at it. Then shall your light rise in darkness, and your gloom be as the noonday. Why, you will be as a light in a dark place, and that's the very thing that Jesus said he wanted you to be. And the very darkest part of you will be as bright as noon. Not only that, and the Lord will guide you continually. Why, you'll experience guidance. And somehow or other, when you've got a problem, I know it works with me, and I think I've got to get off and work on this problem. Somehow or other, if I give myself to somebody else and do something and pour out my soul, I come back and in a flash, a lot of times, I have the answer to my problem. He says, I'll guide you. Guidance will be yours. And satisfaction. And satisfy your desire with good things. And what a satisfaction of knowing your conscience is clear. And what a satisfaction to know you've helped somebody. Then, and this, and that, and another, and yet another. He says, and make your bones strong. I like that much better than the King James. because we Weight Watchers don't like to have your bones made fat, anything made fat. This says here, that says make fat your bones. This says make your bones strong. You know, there's an interesting... we've got a little secret club. I go around to some of these staff conferences and somebody will come up to me and say, they say, I hear you're in Weight Watchers. Says, yeah, you too? Yeah, I am too. So we have a little secret code, language talk. I've had quite the time. And especially, it's rather interesting because when I go, there are 80 women and 5 men. I get a charge out of that. But this is make your bones strong. That's what I want. Your bones strong. You know what I think that means? That means that you'll be established. Because over here in Romans, it says, now to him who is able to strengthen you or establish you. And John Stott tells me that's the New Testament word for follow-up. And that word establish means a prop or a support, like the foundation of the house, or like the legs of a chair, or like the bones of a leg. He'll make your bones strong. You will be established. You follow up somebody else, and it follows you up. He that watereth shall be watered also himself. It's reciprocal. And not only that, and you shall be like a watered garden. That is, you'll be refreshing. You'll be like a cool stream in a hot desert. And like a spring of water whose waters fail not, be seemingly inexhaustible. It'll just bubble up and bubble up and bubble up. And we've all heard about the person who gave the testimony, how they've gone to this conference and that one, and they go and get the little pitcher of water filled up, and they go home and pour out a little in this testimony and that, and little pour out a little in this service, and pretty soon the pitcher is empty. They'd have to go to another conference and get the little pitcher filled up again so they could pour out a little bit more. And then finally, one time, they went to a conference and they went home with the well. This passage is talking about going home with the well. You'll be like a spring of water whose waters fail not, inexhaustible. And then it says, and your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. One of the most encouraging chapters I've ever read in a book is entitled, No Failure Need Be Final. And it pointed out that Jacob, who was kind of a mama's boy, a sissy, a supplanter, about everything I wouldn't like in a friend. And he apparently didn't like himself too well either. But you know, when that night the angel wrestled with him, and his name was changed from Jacob, which means supplanter, to Israel, which means prince with God. You know how old he was? He was 80 years old. That encourages me, because I don't want to be like this all my life. I like to be changed. And you know, you may feel that in some way you've blown it in your personal life, or your family life, or somehow you may feel that you've been a failure in a ministry. Listen, no failure need be final. Really. Because your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. And any previous damage will be repaired in your life. Isn't that a great thought? Yeah, I like that. He will rebuild and restore. And look, then it says, and you shall raise up the foundations of many generations. Although one can become 1,000. And you'll have a new name. You will be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in. Why, you are the person, there was the breach in the wall, the enemy was pouring in. You are the one that came there, pushed him back, and built up the breach. You are the one who gave them paths to dwell in. And I think that means back to the Bible. So their feet can walk on these paths. Now, just think about that. Two ifs. Put away sin and pour out yourself for others. And 9 thens. Two ifs and 9 thens. If you'll do this, God will do this and this and this and this. And I want to wind up with pointing out, this is a principle, isn't it, that runs all the way through the Bible. Take Luke 6:38, for instance. Give, and it shall be given unto you. Good measure, braced down, shaken together, running over, shall men give into your bosom. For with the same measure that you give will be the measure you get. Give, and it should be given unto you. For instance, take money. Money. You short of money? Well, now, Leroy Iams was telling how a few years back when their budget was low and they're really running behind and they prayed about it and thought about it, the first step of action they took was to increase their giving. And that's the right action. Give and it shall be given unto you. That is a step of faith which God honors and he multiplies. And in the great chapters on giving in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, he says, if you sow sparingly, you reap sparingly. If you sow bountifully, you will reap bountifully. Years ago, when I first had my first area, old Doc Jepson up in Seattle told me, I was just a kid, I don't know what I was, 21, 2, I guess I was 23, had my first area. And one of the first things he had told me, he said, now remember, give your tithe to the Lord first before you pay the rent, before you buy the food, before anything else. The Lord first. Honor the Lord with thy substance and with the first fruits of all thine increase. And I tell you, give and it should be given unto you, and that's followed us all the way down through the years, including the generosity of you and some others, for a green Ford Torino sitting out there. No idea, not asked for. But I believe God does this. And this is a reason why we could never have salaries that are always equal, that everybody gets equal income. Because there's some scriptural principles here that this guy may follow, this one does not. And that one is give and it shall be given unto you. Or take the matter of evangelism. I remember when Doug Sparks was here, he gave a testimony of how he realized that he wasn't leading anybody to Christ. And as he prayed about it, the thought came to him, the reason he wasn't reaping was because he wasn't sowing. So he decided his job was to go around town starting to sow. And among the reaping that came, of course, one was Will Perkins, who owns a Perkins automobile agency out here. Or take the matter of friendship. If a person's lonely, they need friendship. They must give in order to get. So they should go look for somebody who's lonely. Seek to encourage them and to comfort them. And then lo and behold, they'll find that God raises up, maybe not that person, but other people to come and minister to them in their lives. Give and it shall be given unto you. If you do this and this, then God will do this and this and this and this and this and this. It's a principle. A little investment that you make for God, a fantastic dividend is reaped. That's the way God does things, isn't it? So, give and it shall be given to you. Give up your sin. Give yourself to serving others, and it'll be given to you over and over and over and over again. By faith you give God a little, and he turns around and gives back much. He multiplies your seed sown. So, we respond to the ifs, and we'll experience the thens.